College students are struggling to find Christ in a culture that rejects God. They need the Christmas message of hope and truth now more than ever. Thanks to a generous matching gift, every dollar you give to the Thomistic Institute before December 31st will be doubled, so your gift will touch twice as many souls. You can give the greatest of all gifts by sending the light of Christ to students aching for truth. Please use the link below or go to thomisticinstitute.org/donate to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Aristotle says about studying ethics, there's only one reason to study ethics. You don't study ethics just for the sake of understanding stuff better. The reason that you study ethics is if you intend to change your life. If you don't intend to change your life, there's absolutely no reason to understand these things, to pursue these things. What we're going to be talking about, friendship, is one of the key central areas of ethics. So I just want to share with you my only interest in friendship is because I'm absolutely convinced that by an astounding divine design, it is at the absolute center of human happiness. For Aristotle, for Christians, someone who is living in true friendship is someone who is living the good life. What does it take to be able to do that? One thing we can say absolutely for sure about true friendship is it never, ever happens by accident. True friendship comes only to those who know what they're looking for and go about intentionally forming it. Friendship is just one of those things. I'm going to tell you here in a little bit, I think one of our biggest challenges is we don't realize just how difficult it is to do it. So at one and the same time here, I hope that in some important sense, I complicate your world a little bit, but also give you some encouragement and give you a few principles. At the end of the evening, ladies and gentlemen, my hope is that you'll make some concrete resolutions that might make a little difference in your pursuing true friendship. So, what's my plan here? I'm going to give you two principles about true friendship and then tell you three specific problems I think we have today in pursuing it. I ask you to prepare your questions to me. It's very important to be able to talk afterwards. I will not be offended by anything. If you want to ask for clarification, something wasn't clear, you want to disagree, you want to draw me out, whatever it is, just please be ready for that, and we will absolutely leave time for that. Here are the two principles. Very simply, shared life consists especially in growing in virtue together. Shared life consists especially in growing in virtue together. Second principle, shared life consists especially in rich conversations. The backdrop for that, of course, ladies and gentlemen, is that friendship is about shared life. And may I just simply say this, what else is there? We were designed not just to live. There's no such thing as real life lived alone. We were designed for shared life. We were designed for friendship. So that's why we have those two key principles about what shared life is. Three specific problems. One, we think we have better friends than we do. Not trying to be aggressive, not trying to be in your face, but do I want to shake things up a little bit? Yes, I do. We think we have better friends than we do. Two, we lack cultural habits, practices, and contexts that support deeper friendship. It's a very big problem. We lack cultural habits, practices and contexts that support deeper friendship. 3, our digital practices disembody our friendships and thereby disembowel them. Again, a third problem, our digital practices disembody our friendships and thereby disembowel them. All right, principle number 1, shared life consists especially in growing in virtue together. The backdrop for this, I never tire of saying this. May I put it to you this way? When I teach philosophy, frankly, the only reason I'm interested in philosophy is because it leads to theology. It leads to the Lord. But good philosophy has the power to do that. Good philosophy is always interested in going more deeply into the most important things. But the most important things are always right before our eyes. So we have to be willing to take things that maybe we've heard numbers of times before, but look again and try to look more deeply. Always the key in growing in wisdom is to recognize what we haven't seen. As Socrates says, the blindness that's the killer is the blindness to your blindness. It's one thing to be blind. It's death-dealing to be blind and not know that you're blind. So often we don't see what we're not seeing. We're not aware of these very fundamental things that are right there before our eyes. The words, we constantly hear them, and so we stop thinking about them and we don't notice. So I'm going to invite you to look again. Virtue, ladies and gentlemen, this is so beautiful. Aristotle, Plato, they're certainly not perfect. But what key insight did they have into human life that we should never stop wondering at? To be virtuous is to be happy. It is to be flourishing. Happiness is not the prize that is given as an award for having been virtuous. If we think that, we're not even seeing what the Greeks saw, much less Christianity. To live a certain sort of way, a certain kind of character, again, even to be aware, even when we say virtuous living, it's great to say to ourselves again, do we really know what the virtues are? Really, only those who live them really know what they are at the end of the day. But we remind ourselves, to be virtuous is to be most fully alive. This is what we're designed for. This is human happiness. So friendship is then living virtuously together. And what can I say? That can sound so boring. So ho-hum, living virtuously together. I ask you seriously, again, what else is there? What else would possibly fulfill your noble, astoundingly crafted soul than to become virtuous and to be virtuous together with those that you love? This is human life. So our principle again, shared life consists especially in growing in virtue together, because this is the amazing thing. By an astounding design of God, we don't come out virtuous. We're made for virtue. We have the potential for it. We will only be our true selves. I love that line. What does it mean really to love somebody? Maybe one day you'll be blessed to be a parent and have the astounding experience, a little reflection of what it must be like for God to look upon us and see in your children something that they can't see yet, who they most of all are when they become themselves by fulfilling God's plan for them, most of all by becoming virtuous. That's who they most of all are, even though they're not it yet. So by his plan, we have to move together towards it. And that's part of our great joy. So central is it's growing in virtue together. The great culmination will be being virtuous together, but there's great joy There's great life simply in the process. So that it, just a very concrete way of picturing what friends are. Of course, you know that we can't, you know the basic things. Well, you don't. From Aristotle, true friendship, you really know who the other person is. You see him for who he really is. And you love him for his own sake. These simple things that make us wonder every time we hear it said again. Imagine two people. They really know one another. They really love that person according to whom he's most called to be. And loving, I want your flourishing. I want you to become who you are, which means, in view of the principles just enunciated, I want you to be virtuous. What can sound like some type of pious abstraction is far from it. It's the stuff of life. Maybe you'll be called and choose to be married. Or at the center of every day of your life is to look upon another person where your fundamental disposition, what can I do to help you become you? So we grow in virtue together. So of course, that's one instance of true friendship, but what I'm most going to focus on here is especially same sex. I ask you to understand that as I'm intending it. Same-sex friendship are the central friendships I'm going to invite you to focus on. I'm going to tell you also right now, I hope that at the end of the evening, you're thinking of one or two that you intend to go deeper with, that you're going to be very discerning about, that you're going to be intentional about, and try to build something more with, starting right there. So again, with this principle of growing in virtue together, key final point on it means holding one another accountable. I want to push you. I'm very impressed already with this community. I was basking in having people walk past and say, "Good evening, sir." I'm like, "You got to be kidding me!" Like, "Good evening to you too." Yeah, absolutely. Good evening. I mean, truly. There's something so life-giving about that. Don't underestimate it. Enter into it. Make it your own. Life is serious, and sometimes it's short. Don't miss it. It's great to say good evening to people. It means something. Hold one another accountable. It's one thing we're talking about over dinner. This is a deeper kind. There's many kinds of friendship. Ladies and gentlemen, we don't have much time here. We're focusing on the deepest kind. We're focusing on what Aristotle is going to call virtuous friendship. We're focusing on what you can only have with a very small number of people. Holding one another accountable here is a full life thing. It's broad. Sure, does it include, are you getting your work done? Absolutely. Are you getting up at the right time in the morning? Sure, that's because that's all part of the big picture. But it's most of all about the most important things. Your spiritual life. Your interior life. The steps that you're taking to grow in virtue. A friend is someone that is always ready. This is not off a Hallmark greeting card, ladies and gentlemen. Who truly looks upon you and says to you, "John, are you being yourself right now? Is that your true self?" And they're coming from a close place. They're coming from a place of understanding and love. You trust it. You don't feel threatened by this because it's coming from, it's never going to tear you down. It's simply coming from a place of course, I want you to be yourself. And I'm always going to be here to remind you for your sake, not for my sake. And we count on one another to do that. How many people actually have such a relationship? It's an astounding thing to achieve. Our second principle is shared life consists especially in rich conversations. I'm not going to say much about this other than to say right now, there are conversations and there are conversations. and we've got to learn the difference. And as almost all the most important things in life, this is tricky. Again, always the principle is we have to be ready to realize what we're not seeing. There's so much in self-knowledge. When we hear good conversation, meaning when we hear the term conversation, is our kind of default position, oh, great, yeah, sure, you know, I do that. Or is it, wow, let me look at my life and let me ask myself, do I really, am I capable of this? Do I prioritize it? Do I enter into it? Do I make it happen? Aristotle asks, when are friends most alive? Which, frankly, is the same thing as to ask, when is a human person most alive? May I provoke you just a little bit? Ask anybody who's been married, who have a reasonably good marriage for any length of time, and ask them, when are you most alive? There's only one answer to that question. And it's in conversation. Because that's when two human beings share their souls with one another. If we think about it truly, and it's almost a little bit scary, say this to a child, this is what heaven's going to be, and it makes the child or any who are immature, and as Aristotle says, there are people that are immature in age, and then there are plenty of us who are immature in character, even if not in age, of thinking, well, that would get boring, wouldn't it? Would it? So it's always great to ask ourselves, what kind of conversations are we capable of having? I'm just going to give you a quick quotation here. Quotation number three on the handouts. Okay, if you don't have the handout, this is so Aristotle. Quotation number three. Talk about the living together of friends. This takes place through constant association and exchange of thoughts and reflection. In this way, men are said to dwell with one another. Men, human beings, are said to live with one another in an appropriate manner, not as cattle feeding together, but as human beings living a life that is proper to them. Images are important. That image right there is stolen from the Republic. Plato is the master of images. There's so many memorable ones. I invite you to keep that one with you, not for the sake of being judgmental of others, but for the sake of being discerning about what's going on in our own life. How many contexts, and we're going to circle back to this and give you some challenges, how many contexts that we find ourselves in, say, of a Friday night, are more like cattle feeding together than like human persons sharing a profound life together? So what is real conversation? What is real human conversation? Only those who learn how to do it ever really know. That's not anything to be scared about. It's something to be inspired by. Let's become that person. All right, first problem. We think we have better friends than we do. I lecture a bit on friendship. I've never met a person who says, you know, it's the darndest thing. I don't have any friends. You never heard anybody say that. Everybody sees themselves as having friends. And in some sense, it's true. So I'm not saying everyone's out there deceiving themselves. But the art of life, ladies and gentlemen, is the art of seeing how to do friendship. I mean, really, again, at risk of annoying you, I'm going to say it again. What else is there? Friendship encompasses, I present for your consideration, absolutely everything else that there is. So we all have some kinds of friends. But when the more we start to talk about and think about and study the whys on what real friendship is, the richer kind of friendship is, we might start to realize, oh my goodness, I have a number of people that I call friends, but I don't really have any of, may I put it this way, the only kind of friendship that removes loneliness. I just met outside a gentleman who's a teacher in high school, and he just said, my students are profoundly lonely. Every one of them will say they have friends. And in some sense of the term, they do. It's really dramatic. But a real friendship, a la what Aristotle is talking about, how to even say it, to even really have one of these, you're never alone. Even when you're alone. Because you are known, you are seen. God knows. We need to be seen. We need to experience ourselves as being seen and loved. So this richer kind of friendship is the only thing that takes away, to say it negatively, human loneliness. So there's so many that don't realize, they don't know what they don't have. And so I'm just going to invite you here in thinking about this problem to have a kind of approach of, I'm going to be more intentional about looking through. And here's the thing. I want you to be grateful for all of your friendships. Never try to make a friendship be more than it reasonably can be. This is part of the challenge here. One of the things that modern society, the main lies that's consistently said to us is, you can have friendship, you can make a good friendship with anybody. All human persons are naturally capable of true friendship if we become a certain kind of person, if we cultivate a certain kind of character. But we can't have that friendship unless we become that kind of person. It is consistently peddled to us that you can just choose to be good and kind towards someone, which we should do, and then have a kind of rich friendship with this person, regardless of your difference in values, etc. I'm all for having great, respectful relationships with people that you have different values with, from. That you don't share things deeply with, but you still are kindly, you are friendly, and respectful. That is not a virtuous friendship. And we need to have that conceptually distinct and recognize, yep, we relate with almost everybody in a friendly way. But you go deeper in true friendship with a few. And the great question that we keep asking ourselves is, am I capable of this? And who else among my acquaintances or my friends in the broad sense are going to be capable of going more deeply with me in this special kind of way? Second problem, we lack cultural habits, practices, and contexts that support deeper friendship. Ultimately, I'm hoping we'll be able to talk about this a bit in our kind of discussion time. Just say a couple quick things here. It's connected to the first of our points of our problem of our thinking that we have more friends than we do, and it's going to be connected to the third where I bring up the more virtual thing explicitly. But a couple comments. Our culture does not understand what virtuous/true friendship is. So it doesn't know how to cultivate it. If we don't know what it demands, we're not going to be intentional about making it happen. Aristotle and Plato, just as a point of reference, thought one of the most important things that government should do, that rulers should do, is try to arrange things to make virtuous friendship possible among people. May I present for your consideration, this is a great way of thinking about parenting. What can I do to make my children be more capable of, disposed towards, have context for real friendship. Again, especially today, we're going to have to be intentional about that because others are not doing that for us. This is closely connected to a skewed hierarchy of goods. Consider what we generally honor people for: business success, sports, achieving their dreams, whatever their dreams might be. Friendship is everyone grants that you want to have it, but it's always ancillary. It's always just kind of on the side there. It's not something that you have to set up and really pursue specifically. What habits, practices, and contexts? That was my little trio there, my suggesting that we lack. Here are just a couple of them. It's very countercultural, even might I say politically incorrect, to really hold people accountable. Again, I'm not talking about gym partners. I'm not talking about making sure we get our studying done. I'm all for it. Holding people accountable in the interior life, in pursuing virtue, this is not something that we commonly in our culture think in terms of. How about this one? Shared deliberation about life based on timeless principles. This, in a healthy culture, this is one of the main things that young people would be encouraged to do. We want to be asking one another, how can we craft a better life together in view of basic principles? Do you notice, I want to go on a big sidebar on a cultural critique, but this mode of thinking is just not on our radar. We're always more just like simply trying to, you know, get to know where others are, kind of respect where they are, which is a very important thing, but is distinct from, we don't pursue, we don't have a sense of, let's agree on the basic principles about what it is to be human and what happiness is, so that then we can launch into using that to think together about life. Contexts. I am not going to pursue with you here. I love when talking about marriage, to make a point from a thinker, Kentucky farmer by the name of Wendell Berry, that you may or may not have heard of, who makes a big deal of our homes have been eviscerated. We don't have the traditional arts that go on in the home that are the contexts for marriage and relationship between parents and children. Our home life has been eviscerated, so we don't have it as a context for shared life. What's the parallel for you all? That might be a problem at home, but as kind of young adults, what contexts have been, as it were, taken away from you? What contexts are given to you? But what I mean by context, often like a physical place that is kind of arranged in a certain way that we have habits of coming to, where do we really have context where it's easy to break into deeper and sustained discussion? Think about how in so many ways we don't have those physical places, and even if we do have that physical place, when we're in it, we have the problem of our technologies that take us away from that place. And so we're not, as it were, forced into the bodily presence, the eye contact, that is the grounding for the very thing they were saying of not like cattle feeding together, but actually rich conversations. There's a way that looks. And in our common practices, another aspect, think of how we get together socially as young people. By and large, our social contexts lend themselves to shallow interactions, to being more about appearance, to being more of like a social media event. Don't say this, not trying to be aggressive, but the problem, think what a difference it makes when people's experience of a party is kind of like, hey, does this look good right now? Are we having fun here yet? And we're more looking at it from an appearance viewpoint rather than a rich way of just being together. So we don't have the context that would have helped us there. Third problem, I make a couple suggestions and I'm done. Our digital practices disembody our friendships and thereby disembowel them. I want to give you just a couple of quotations here from this book. There's a number of books on this topic, and you've probably all have been exposed to some of them. This one is by a woman named Felicia Wu Song. And I'm just going to read you very quickly here, quotations 6, 7, and 8, because I think it is very helpful and I hope will prime our discussion here about how we're going to deal with the kind of digital aspects of our relationships. I'm number 6, the bottom of the first page. If Lanier is right, the contemporary digital story not only competes against the spiritual frameworks we profess, it also distorts and undermines our capacity to commune with God and others in the ways that we were created, because it baptizes us into particular conceptions of time, place, relationship, and the human condition. I know that's kind of abstract. Hang with me. This is a profound indictment of those of us in faith communities who only see technology as a tool. It reveals how we severely underestimate the deeply spiritual function that digital technologies actually play in our struggles against isolation, fear, meaninglessness. This possibility should make any person of faith sit up and take a sober look at whether their digital practices reveal about the substance of what they actually believe and trust. Number 7, taking the word liturgies and using this in a broad sense, liturgies are embodied practices that possess the power to cultivate the stuff of our imaginations and the very longings of our being. In this light, our digital routines and habits, so pervasive in their range, are no longer merely matters of incidental preference or personal inclination. Rather, seeing them through the lens of liturgy reveals our digital routines to be the consequential matters of personal and soul formation that they really are. One more. Together, the designs and norms of digital life ultimately immerse us in a story about the human condition that bends our assumptions to regard embodiment, being in our bodies in a place, as a nuisance, attention as the measure of worth, the other as an object, in time in terms of scarcity. I know there was a little bit of abstractness in there. I very much encourage you to go and look that up. What is being suggested there? I want to push you and I want to scare you a little bit by saying she's suggesting the things that you and I simply take for granted, in especially how we use our phones, how changes how we experience the most fundamental aspects of what human living together actually is. I want to give you one simple, not even the most dramatic example. I've been inviting students over to my house. My wife and I love to have them into our living room for a very long time. And people sometimes say, well, what are the biggest differences that you see in your students? One of the most dramatic things we do is go back X number of years, 20 years ago, you invite students over for the evening, they're in your living room, they're just there. And things are going to unfold. You know, whatever it is, we're going to play a game, we're going to read something out loud, are we going to have a conversation? What's it going to look like? Now, you feel on them at any moment, they're going to be, as it were, somewhere else. They actually they're not fully there in their body. It's very difficult for me to enunciate this, and if I were to say it to them, they have nothing to compare it to, and so they don't know what I'm talking about. Part of that, by the way, is this. It's really funny. It's a simple thing, but it makes a big difference. So often, halfway through an evening, a bunch of people just get up and say, we've got to go. Got something else that's going on. It's amazing how the way that your generation communicates, there's always this sense of someone's going to arrange something, they're going to let me know, and I'm going to go, and I got to be there. So it's like, Dr. Cutterback, thanks so much for having us over. We're going now. They don't even expect to just kind of spend the evening there. Or while they are, they're half wondering what's going on other places. Is someone trying to contact them? Ladies and gentlemen, please understand. This is not some type of just swipe at your generation. In many ways, I'm on my knees inviting you to look and say, this is something in your power to come to a greater awareness of, comprehension of, and ask, what might I do? I can't change the age I live in. But what might I do to mitigate, to work against this kind of powerful push that we're getting? How can I start to do certain things that will work towards real bodily presence and living together as human beings do? A couple quick suggestions, and then I want your questions. Already said it, I'm just going to say it again. Choose to prioritize just a couple of virtuous friendships. I'm going to read you line, quotation number 9. You ready for this? This is St. Alward of Ravoux, great medieval theologian. This is how discerning we're going to have to be. This is really challenging. Especially in choosing and testing a friend, we should take precautions, if possible, not to set our hearts too quickly. Now, how many do I love to whom it would be indiscreet to bare my mind and open my heart in this way, since they are not old enough, mature enough, or discreet enough for such intimacies? Indeed, as Blessed Ambrose says, between the ill-matched, friendship cannot exist, and therefore the graces of each should blend with each other. What I'm suggesting here is, one of the hardest parts here is, people are afraid they're being judgmental. When I say that the wise are uniform on this, we have to be super discerning. Can I go deeper with this person? And if you're tempted to think that's being unduly judgmental, I'd put it to you this way. It's not being judgmental. It's trying to judge about the truth and live in the truth. Again, I say, never try to have a deeper friendship with someone than is reasonably possible. And this includes coming to know ourselves. Not just looking outward and saying, who of these people could I go deeper with? It's constantly asking myself, what am I doing to make myself be more capable of it? So again, first suggestion, choose to prioritize a couple and be intentional. Second, think in terms of conducive contexts. We could talk about that more in our discussion. I started to say a little bit about that. All living things need a conducive context to thrive. Friendship is a living thing. Treat it like a plant. It has to be watered. It has to be protected. What are the contexts that lend themselves to really getting to know one another? It's hard to know other persons. What are we going to do to try to have the situations when we can have the kind of conversations where we really can get to know one another, where we can really share about deeper things? Where are we going to emphasize bodily presence? You're tired of me saying that to you, but I'm going to say it one more time. Bodily presence is always the gold standard. Is there a place for connecting to someone remote through technology? Of course there is. My daughter is married to a gentleman who is in the Army, and they're in Fort Carson, Colorado. And so I have several grandchildren there. Do I FaceTime with them? Yes, I do. But I always am trying to stay very aware of not somehow treating this as somehow this is interchangeable. This is, with them, it's the only possibility right now for a certain kind of contact. So I make that judgment and I do it. But what about can you really develop a deeper friendship over that? We can come back and look at that a little bit more. Prioritize silence and make it happen. I just want to read you quotation number 12 an astounding book by Cardinal Seurat called The Power of Silence. Silence is indispensable if we are to find God. Number 12, the Father waits for his children in their own hearts. Solitude is the best state in which to hear God's silence. For someone who wants to find silence, solitude is the mountain that he must climb. More broadly, may I put it this way? Silence, interior life. Medieval Dominican said, we cultivate silence as a way of cultivating speech. If friendship is about conversation, we need to have something to say. Cultivate silence to cultivate interior life so we have something to share. Final suggestion, I hope you can work on this as a community. Most of you are from one community here, and then a number of you are from another community that's kind of right next door, and maybe you all, in one sense, move into one community all together. These things, making certain kind of convictions about what technologies we're going to use, how we're going to use them, what kind of parties are we going to have? What kind of social gatherings are we going to have? What kind of dances are we going to have? What are we going to do when we go out together? Much of young life is lived there. Gather together and make some resolutions, may I suggest, together. Some of you take the leadership on that. Let's do something different in this community. Don't be negative about it. It doesn't matter what other communities are doing. What are you all doing right here? How are you going to change what you do among one another to set up the context that are supportive for then those deeper special friendships that arise in the context of this broader community that you have, sharing these principles is going to make more possible that resolution that you have to go deeper with those few people that you can go deeper with. Thanks so much for your attention.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.